Okay, everyone. So let us get into the questions. I'm not sure if these are the questions from yesterday, but hopefully they are. We'll just do those first, then we'll carry on. Good evening, Ajahn. Can you please elaborate on the right view of I? Many thanks. Maybe better to call it the wrong view of I, but anyway, it is the view about I. Remember, the idea in Buddhism is that we have a fundamental wrong view of the world. The way we look at the world is not the way the world is. And at the root of that misunderstanding, what you might call a delusion or a distortion of perception, of views of the mind, is the sense that you exist in a certain way. Yeah, you have a feeling of I. And that feeling of I that you have is at root problematic. It is different from the reality of things. And that is that root sense of I is what causes all the problems in the world and causes every, you know, all the cravings and all the desires and all the identity and everything, really. And this is what we are kind of ultimately, in the end, trying to rectify, so that we see that that I that we feel does not correspond to any reality inside of us. We don't have that kind of identity. And when you see that, you give up the kind of that feeling of I that you had before. It kind of disappears, and you don't have it anymore. So this is what kind of is the root point of this. And you start to understand this already as you do your meditation practice. You actually reduce the sense of I through your meditation, because when you meditate, a lot of the I manifests in the way you think about things. In fact, the very fact that you are thinking usually comes from the sense of I. So by reducing the thinking mind and reducing all the self-concern and all of those things, you actually are already reducing the sense of I. So it starts through meditation. The deeper you go into meditation, the less sense of I there is, gradually reducing until one day you have that full insight and understanding, and there's like a complete overturning of the mind and seeing things in an entirely new way. So the right view of I is really just a kind of preliminary view that we have, that we are going to try to see the mind for what it is, and try to understand that a lot of the things that we see are just illusions. A lot of the problem is this delusion that we have, which is very deeply embedded in human beings. Dear Ajahn, is it important to have good meditation experiences before one becomes a monastic? I quite enjoy monastery stays and feel at home in the monastery, but meditation is not yet good enough to find happiness there. Alone, or for the most part, happiness there alone for the most part. Thank you. The monastic life is lived to improve yourself and to change and to move in a certain direction. And you don't really have to have any specific experiences before you become a monastic. The most important thing is that you have enough confidence and faith in the teachings to sustain your life in a monastery. That is what really matters. And as long as you live your monastic life and there's a sense of improvement, a sense that you're going somewhere, then that monastic life, you will be able to sustain it, because there's a sense of purpose there. You're moving in a certain direction. Something is happening in your life. And it is more likely that you will have that sense of improvement as a monastic than as a layperson, because the conditions are more conducive, basically. So there isn't any prerequisite. There is no you don't have to have anything really together before you become a monastic. All you have to do is you have to have this feeling of confidence and faith that you will be able to live that monastic life and follow the rules and regulations that are required in the monastic setting. That's really all. You will find that monastics are very varied in their meditation experiences and the meditation abilities. It varies enormously. What really matters is only your commitment and your ability to live that life well. That is all that matters. All right. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned yesterday, I'm not sure if this is yesterday or the day before yesterday, but anyway, we'll find out, that the bad effects of killing are due to the violent, cruel thoughts, intention in the mind while performing the action. Suppose a grandfather takes his young grandson for a lovely afternoon of bonding while fishing. They catch a few fish, chatting away, enjoying their time together. That evening they may cook the fish they caught for dinner. If there were no thoughts, intentions of violence, cruelty or ill will, does the scenario still have grave karmic consequences? Well, grave is a matter of that is how grave it is. It's not clear how grave it is. Killing a few fish, it depends on the rest of your character, how many good things you have done, how diluted these things are by your good actions. Remember that the famous simile of the lump of salt in the water is a really good one to explain how karma is diluted and the effects of bad karma. And for those of you who haven't heard that simile, the simile is if you have a small amount of water, like a cup of water, and you put a lump of salt in the cup of water, it becomes very salty. In this case, the lump of salt is the bad karma, and the amount of water is the good karma that you have made, and the consequences are very strong. It becomes very... the effects of the bad karma are bad. That's why the water is so salty. Take exactly the same lump of salt, the same amount of bad karma, and put it in a large pond or a river, and you won't barely taste anything at all, if anything. It's because the bad karma is diluted in a larger pool of good karma. This is kind of the idea. So exactly how killing those fish affect you will depend enormously on all kind of things. And it's not necessarily bad karma. But... if you go fishing, you are intentionally killing fish. You can't get away from that. That's kind of the reality of it. And you may say that, yes, maybe it is slightly ameliorated by the fact that you are doing it for a good purpose. You're bonding with your grandson, and maybe you wouldn't kill those fish if it hadn't been for that. So, of course, it depends on your mind state. But it is still a bad idea to kill fish. You find another way of bonding with your grandson, than fishing. It doesn't have to be killing fish or doing something unwholesome. So, yes. All right. Dear Ajahn, is being with the same as choiceless awareness? But isn't there still a choosing the will in choiceless being choiceless? A paradox, or am I simply confused? There is, I think, at the end of the, if you really look at it very deeply, I don't think there is such a thing as choiceless awareness. There's no such thing, because everything you are aware of, there is a degree of choice there. There's a degree of intention behind that. But the point is more like, well, to what extent are we forcing the mind or willing the mind to look at certain things? There may be, it is more like the automatic intention of the mind, where the mind does things more or less on its own, and you're not directing it, you're not using any effort, you're not using any willpower. Or there is a lot of willpower behind things, where you force your mind onto things. And so the idea is to have minimum amount of force, minimum amount of willing. So you just stand back and you kind of allow the mind to do its own thing. And that is the idea of choiceless awareness. But at root, you're right, at root there's always going to be choice. The question is how much effort you're putting into it, how much willing you're putting into it, how much of yourself you're putting into that choice. That is really the distinction here. So you allow it to be as automatic as possible. And as you withdraw the choosing of the mind and the doing of the mind, the energy tends to return to the mind, because you were basically depleting the mind of energy by all the doing that we normally get involved in. All right. Dear Ajahn, can you share merits with the deceased pets? Sure, absolutely you can do that. You can share merits with any being, deceased, any kind of being. So please do so. It's kind of a nice idea, isn't it, to help your pets as well. I like that. Like that idea. So absolutely, go for it. Dear Ajahn, last night you mentioned we don't pray to the Buddha as there is nothing there. He has finished something to those words. Can you please explain what happened to our mind enlightened when we die? Can you be enlightened in the bardo? Thank you. So the purpose of Buddhism is to end dukkha, end suffering. That's kind of what Buddhism is about. And an enlightened person is someone who has ended suffering. That's kind of what it means to be enlightened. What that means is that you don't get reborn, because the whole process of rebirth is what sustains suffering. So when you get enlightened, you don't get reborn. And that kind of gives an idea what happens when you die. You don't go anywhere. You don't go even to the bardo, because the bardo is like a kind of mini rebirth. You go to hang out somewhere in the bardos or whatever. So that is the idea of enlightenment. So what does it mean when you don't get reborn? Exactly what is going on there? And the answer is that things just come to an end. That's really what it means. But it's hard to understand. And the reason why it is very hard to understand these things is because the sense of self kind of worms its way into our understanding. And the sense of self wants to exist, or sometimes it wants to be annihilated. And both of those are wrong views. So, as long as the sense of self is there, it's very difficult to understand the idea of ending and cessation. And for that reason, I think it's better to think of awakening as the highest happiness. The kind of the elimination of all suffering, the elimination of the defilements of the mind, and all of these kind of things. So you see it in a positive way, because that is the whole point. That is it's the highest kind of meaning of life that you attain when you become awakened. So it is the highest kind of happiness. And that is what really matters. That is the purpose of the Buddha's teachings. Buddha understands the difference between happiness and suffering, and he guides you towards happiness. So instead of trying to understand exactly what it means, what ending means, think of it more in terms of happiness. How can you understand that? Well, if you have a little bit of peace in your meditation, how does it feel? It feels good. If you get a bit of joy in the meditation, it feels good. If you get even more joy in a meditation, it feels even better. If you find incredibly high amounts of peace and joy in a meditation, even better. And every time you get more joy, every time you get more peace, you are approaching enlightenment. You are approaching Nibbana. You are achieving Nibbana to some extent, because there are certain things that are being extinguished. Nibbana means extinguishment, and the more peaceful you are, the more things are being extinguished. Right? Thinking is extinguished, bad feelings in the body are extinguished. Things being extinguished are great. It kind of feels really nice. So the more things get extinguished, the more happy you are. So after a while, you become addicted to extinguishment. This is kind of a nice kind of addiction. And so you carry on extinguishing until you come to the highest kind of extinguishment. So if a little bit of extinguishment is a little bit of happiness, and a middle amount of extinguishment is a middling amount of happiness, then the highest extinguishment must be the highest happiness. Right? Are you sure? So this is kind of the paradox of Buddhism, right? But you can see how it kind of makes sense. And so you have to have a degree of trust that this is heading in that way. All right. Dear Ajahn, this morning you mentioned about the bhikkhuni ordination, Ajahn Brahm being rejected by his mates for that. A question: what is the current state of affairs now, Ajahn Brahm being accepted again? The current state of affairs is that, the thing is that sometimes these things are, I'm not sure how to say this, but to me some of these things are good results. Right? It is not necessarily bad to be rejected in this way. And the reason it is not bad is because sometimes you have a different view of the world, and you look at things in a different way, and your approach to the Dhamma, to the ordination of bhikkhunis, all of these things can be different. And sometimes a separation is just the natural way of things, because you have different views. So the idea that, Ajahn Brahm being rejected by his mates is a bad thing, I don't think that necessarily is true. Sometimes it's a good thing, because maybe there was over time due already that a separation should happen. This is just the way things are. That's why Buddhists tend to hang out with Buddhists. Christians tend to hang out with Christians. Muslims tend to hang out with Muslims. Why? Because we have similar outlook, similar views of the world. It is not always true. Sometimes we meet because there are commonalities between these religions in many ways as well. So sometimes we can meet, but very often we tend to separate into groups according to our views. Why? Because it's much easier to live with someone who has similar views to you. Yeah, it makes more sense. You have more grounds for having nice discussions, talking about nice things, discussing the teachings. It's very hard if you live with someone with a very different kind of view. So sometimes when these things happen, I don't think it is a bad thing, right? It is, in retrospect, to be honest with you, I think maybe it was a good thing. Yeah, why? Because your viewpoint is just different. And how is it? Well, I just heard today, it was very interesting, that Ajahn Brahm is in Indonesia right now, and he just met up, apparently, Indonesia with the abbot of Wat Phapong. Yeah, apparently, abbot of Wat Phapong, Ajahn Liem, he was also in Indonesia, and they met up, and they had a conversation, or I don't know what they did, took a picture together anyway, because the picture was there. Don't know what that means. They're all smiling on the picture, of course. But the thing is that someone like Ajahn Brahm, he doesn't hold any ill will or any grudges because of that. It's just nature. Things happen. And I'm sure the abbot of Wat Phapong, Ajahn Liem, very well-known monk, highly respected, I don't think he can do it. He doesn't carry any grudges either. I'm absolutely sure. So all the good monks, they don't carry grudges. It's all water under the bridge. It's all past history. And yes, we are divided. But so what? The world is always going to be divided. That's the nature of things. We go into groups. So it doesn't matter. What matters is how we carry on forward. Do we carry grudges in our heart, or do we just have metta and compassion for everyone involved? Because this is the nature of the world. Is everyone reasonably happy now, especially those conservative Buddhist country like Thailand and Myanmar? Is everyone reasonably happy? Some people are happy, some people are unhappy. This is just how the world is. And we wish those who are unhappy, we have compassion for them, and we wish them a way forward so they can also be happy in the future. Something like that. The world is complex. There's always going to be a mixture of conservative people, of a more liberal people, and we should not really, we cannot hope to change the world. We just do what we think is right according to our understandings, and we allow the rest of the world to do what they think is right. And then you just have to shrug your shoulders and allow things to kind of go according to causes and conditions. What about nuns in Tibet? Do they have a level playing field? Not really. Tibetan Buddhism is also quite conservative, and they have like 10 precept nuns, but they don't really have bhikkhunis in the. There's no ordination of bhikkhunis in the Tibetan tradition. How can I, as a layperson, support nuns' community to thrive? This is a very good question. How can you support the nuns' community to thrive? Venerables, would you like to answer that question? How can someone who wants to support the nuns' community to thrive, what is the best thing they can do? Do you have any?
At the moment, a lot of people are already supporting us. It's quite different from different countries. I go to Myanmar, and I can see the difference. But over here, we are very, very well supported.
Okay, good. Excellent.
We are being accepted here.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, that's wonderful. So, I personally would say that the way to support the nuns is to go to the nuns' monastery and to show your support, and to be there, find out what they need and what they require. And these kind of things is the best way to support them. And one of those interesting things is that historically, women's monastic communities have always got less support than male monastic communities. And this seems to go all the way back to the time of the Buddha. You read in the suttas, and the nuns will say it's difficult for nuns to get requisites. This seems to have been something that's been all the way throughout history. And because of that, make sure that you support the women's community, the nuns, and that you don't allow that kind of this sort of difference in support to kind of carry on into the future. And we had this, in Australia now, there's a really very strong movement of bhikkhunis, of nuns. We have the large monastery in Dhammasara Monastery. I think Dhammasara Monastery is a really beautiful monastery. If you haven't been there, I would really recommend you to go there and check it out. It's really magnificent. It's wonderful that women can have such remarkably good facilities to practice the Dhamma. And it's very rare. I don't think there are many monasteries in the world that have the kind of facilities at Dhammasara. It's very rare for bhikkhunis to have this. But bhikkhunis also exist in Australia and other places. There is now a Santi Monastery in Sydney, which is like a branch monastery of Dhammasara, and another beautiful monastery developing over there. There is Newbury Monastery in just outside Melbourne, which also have bhikkhunis. And so Australia is actually doing really, really well as far as bhikkhunis is concerned. So please continue supporting that and show your support for these things. And there are bhikkhunis around the world who are trying to do similar things, like Venerable Chanda trying to establish bhikkhunis in the UK. Much, much more difficult in Europe because there is much less support for these things. There are bhikkhunis communities in Germany as well, but often just one or two bhikkhunis living by themselves, and it's actually quite hard. So keep your eyes and ears open and see what needs are there, and then gradually support this. I think one of the most important things to recognize for me is that bhikkhunis, the female bhikkhus, if you like, female nuns, proper nuns, fully ordained nuns, this was the intention of the Buddha from the beginning, to have fully ordained women on equal level, on par with the bhikkhus. And because that is the intention of the Buddha from the beginning, it is something that we should aspire for in the world, to kind of have the Buddha's vision reappear around the world in various places and not be satisfied with half measures. We want to give women the full opportunity to practice the spiritual path in the same way as men. Otherwise, it's bad. Otherwise, it's terrible. And so we should support the whole idea of bhikkhunis. That whole thing is very important. In places like the UK, for example, in the Ajahn Chah monasteries in the UK, they have invented their own kind of tradition called the Sila Dara tradition. Sila Dara means the one who carries morality, someone who carries morality. And it is like a hybrid thing. They have taken the 10 precept nuns, and they have taken some of the rules of the monks, and they have kind of mixed it all up and stirred it up into a nice mix, and they have kind of called that mix Sila Dara, the nuns who carry morality. But the problem, and it's kind of nice, and intention, of course, is good, and they felt they weren't able to ordain bhikkhunis fully. And so they tried to find a middle way. And I think the intentions are probably very honorable, and they're trying to do something. This was back in the 1980s when they came up with this, or late 70s even. It's a long time ago. But the problem is that there is no, it doesn't have any, it's not authentic. There's no authority behind this. The Buddha isn't behind this, and it will never carry any weight in the Buddhist world. No one is going to accept this as an authentic Buddhist tradition. So in the long run, it is very, very likely to just peter out and disappear again, because it doesn't have that authenticity to it. Whereas the bhikkhuni is, this is an authentic Buddhist tradition. It is real, going back to the Buddha. And so we should support that, and we should bring that back into the world. So when you see the possibility of supporting this, even making these kind of arguments in favor of this, please do so. Don't be too shy about this, and support it wherever you see it. We now see in Sri Lanka the tradition of bhikkhunis is very, very strong. There are thousands of bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka, and that's wonderful. And some of them are practicing really well. And some of them are, maybe not, but there is things going on there which are really good. In Thailand, very strong, lots of bhikkhunis in Thailand now, hundreds of bhikkhunis, and going very well, and generally supported by society, even if they're not supported by the Sangha hierarchy, a large part of the society in these countries, in Sri Lanka in particular, but also in Thailand, actually are supportive of bhikkhunis. Even the monks, yeah, the monks are generally supportive. It is just the hierarchy that sometimes is against it, because hierarchies almost by definition are conservative. Their job is to kind of keep things the way they are. The most conservative of all countries is Myanmar, super duper conservative, and it's impossible to be a bhikkhuni in Myanmar, unfortunately, so that is still to come in the future. But things are changing, and it's a grassroots movement. It is coming from the bottom, building up. These things will never start from the top, because the hierarchies are always conservative. Hierarchies are about power. They are about keeping things the way they are. Because if you are in a position, if you are part of the establishment, you want to keep things the way they are. You don't want to change things. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to stir things up. And so hierarchies are almost always going to be conservative. So these changes start from the bottom up, and that's what we are doing here in Perth. Yeah, we are at the bottom. What a wonderful thing to be at the bottom. You have no power, you don't have any say, but you can do whatever you want, right? As long as you do good things, you can do what you want. And that's what we're doing here, because we don't have any formal power. Of course, someone like Ajahn Brahm has a lot of power in an indirect way, because he is so well known, and he's such a beloved teacher around the world. So he has a lot of informal power, and that's why it really matters. But we have no real power, and so we are outside of the system, and we can do what we want. And what is amazing is that it is respected around the world. When I traveled, I was recently in Thailand in connection with the Vesak celebration in Thailand, and I spoke to some of the very, very senior monks in the Thai Sangha hierarchy. I went to this monk who was almost at the very top of the Sangha in Thailand, and I said, Ajahn Brahm sends his best wishes. And he said, oh, please send my best wishes back to Ajahn Brahm. He knows Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, they have kind of met at these things before. He knows that I am Ajahn Brahm's disciple, and yet he invites me to give a talk at these big events in Thailand. And that's kind of extraordinary. So there isn't really any big problems there. We are respected here in Perth, even though, and perhaps a little bit because we do these kind of things, because we are not afraid, right? We do what is right because we know something is right. And that gets respect, even though some people will find it difficult or whatever. In the long run, people respect people with integrity. And they may see that actually we're doing something very positive. Some of the very senior monks that I met in Thailand as well, they say things like, well, you're in Australia. In Australia, you have to do things differently. You shouldn't have to follow the Thai way of doing things. In Australia, you have to follow the Australian way. Of course, you have to also follow the Dhamma. You can't sort of chuck out the basic ideas of Buddhism. But as long as you keep within the kind of the framework of the Buddhist teachings, then you should adapt to the local culture. And that is what we're doing. And I think it is fundamentally important for the future of Buddhism that we adapt in these ways, because we're not going to be taken seriously unless we have a reasonable sense of equity between women and men in the Buddhist teachings. So I think we are really on the right track. That's one of the things that I think we really did right, was that ordination back in 2009. Yes, there were repercussions, but in the long run, this is the way forward. Anyway, so there you are. That's a kind of long answer to your question. So let's go on to the next one. Could you please speak more about how the idea of the bodhisattva evolved from bodhisattva or one intent on awakening? Where do the Jataka stories come from then? The hypothesis, I mean, this is a little bit difficult to know for sure, but the hypothesis that many people have is that after the Buddha died, you can imagine the Buddha dying would have been very, very traumatic for the Buddhist community. The Buddha answered all questions. He laid down all the rules. He did everything in the monastic community. And without the Buddha, it would have been very, very difficult. And so the hypothesis that as soon as the Buddha died, people would have asked, well, who actually was the Buddha? Where did he come from? What was his background? And then they started to build up the idea of a Buddha biography. Some of that biography is already found in the suttas, because the Buddha talked about his own life, but many of the details were missing. Yeah, and then those details eventually turned into this large Buddha biography, and it was developed after the Buddha passed away, and that includes the Jataka stories. The Jataka stories are not really canonical. They don't come from the earliest period. And they were developed in the years, maybe the centuries after the Buddha passed away. That was when the Buddha biography arose and all of these kinds of things. And gradually, the Bodhisattva ideal, the idea that someone made a determination under a previous Buddha, the Buddha Dipankara, 28 Buddhas ago, and the story is that our present Buddha was called Sumedha at that time, and he would bow down to the Buddha Dipankara, and he said, I make this affirmation, or that I will become a Buddha in the future. And that then becomes the starting point for the purification and for the development of what is called the paramis, which are like these 10 qualities that you develop to perfection, and then you become a Buddha as a consequence. And it takes eons and eons to do this. But this is not in the suttas. The Buddha doesn't talk about this. This is a developed idea that came after the Buddha. So if we read these later stories, and then we think this is what the suttas are about, actually we are reading later ideas back into the suttas. And that is a problem. If you look at what the suttas are saying, they have nothing like that at all. In fact, all the evidence points to exactly the opposite. I'm not going to go through that now, but there's evidence in the suttas that points in exactly the opposite direction. So that's why the idea that in the suttas, instead of bodhisattva referring to a particular kind of being who has practiced for eons and eons to purify themselves and perfect themselves, it seems more to do with a person, someone who is intent on awakening in that life, in that last life they have. And that's really all the bodhisattva is. And that's a very natural and straightforward explanation. And that, to me, is far more satisfactory than this idea of someone who is, the later kind of biography, etc. So, I hope that makes sense. So now I'm going to start from the top again. I'm not sure exactly what happened with this question. This will probably be a bit random, but let's see what happens. Dear Ajahn, if in the Fear and Dread Sutta, why does the one intent on awakening refer to himself as a noble one? I was going to talk about that, but I forgot to talk about that as I was going through it. I am one of the noble ones who frequent remote lodgings, if he is not yet enlightened. It also makes it sound like he was practicing the jhanas for some time before his enlightenment. In a noble search sutta, he remembers practicing the jhanas as a child and then decides that this is the path to awakening. Any thoughts about the chronology? Yes, he does refer to himself as one of the noble ones in that sutta, and that is interesting. I think what that means is that the terms like Arya, the noble ones, are not used consistently in the suttas. When you talk about Arya Pugala, a noble person, usually it means someone on the four stages of awakening, but not always. Sometimes it is used more loosely. And here the Buddha is using it more in a more loose sense of someone of noble character in a more general sense. Remember, all of these words were words that existed in India prior to the Buddha. And because they existed in India prior to the Buddha, they had a pre-existing meaning. And so initially, the Buddha would have used the pre-existing meaning. And then over time, they would crystallize and get the particular Buddhist meaning that they got after a while. So there is like a shift there. And a lot of words are precisely that. The Buddha takes an existing word and gives it a specific meaning. Jhana is an example. Arahant is an example. Tathagata is an example. Lots of words like that. And so here it seems to be used in a more general sense. It does not always mean noble ones. And yes, I would agree with you. It seems like he may have been practicing jhanas for a time, and certainly he would have been practicing for a while to attain those jhanas. Yeah, and he would have kind of been trying quite hard for a while. And when we read the Arya Parihasana Sutta and the Mahasatchaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26 and Majjhima Nikaya 36, Mahasatchaka Sutta, the greater sutta to Satchaka, the Arya Parihasana, the Noble Search Sutta, we should remember it is a contraction of what actually happened, right? So the reality is probably there's far more time between events than what you see in those suttas. So the Buddha does remember the time when he was sitting, his father was working and he was sitting under the rose apple tree and he had a spontaneous experience of jhana, and then he would have started practicing, and then it would have been taking some time, maybe weeks, maybe months, until he then reached awakening. In the sutta it seems to happen very, very quickly, but remember they are contractions of the main events, and then we have to fill in the gaps by, as you do quite rightly do here, pointing out that the other suttas seem to suggest a more protracted period of practice. So, yes. Okay. Dear Ajahn, a Buddhist friend once told me that she wanted to avoid meditation so that she wouldn't go into jhana, which risks rebirth in the plane of deep meditative states. And by the time her time in that realm is up, she could be reborn as an animal or a ghost. She was striving to become a stream enterer, but listened to Dhamma talks instead. I am puzzled. Spiritual materialism, the teaching I have heard thus far, seem to indicate that deep samadhi gives rise to insight. And when the time is right, the fetters are destructed. Thank you. Yes, this is an example of a very bad idea. Yeah, the idea that you should not go into deep meditation because you might get reborn into this realm or that realm. The future is so uncertain. There's no way you can control these things anyway. You don't know where you're going to get reborn. Right? It's just impossible. It is just so uncertain how long the Dhamma is going to be around for. It is so, all of these things are so uncertain. Trying to control these things, I think, is just a fool's game. And it's not something that we should do. What we should do is practice as far as we possibly can in this life, including samadhi. That, to me, is the right approach. And if you do happen to be reborn in a jhana realm, and just because you attain jhana a few times does not mean you will get reborn in a jhana realm. The only way you will be reborn in a jhana realm is if you have access to those jhanas at the time of death. Yeah, so it needs to be something you practice continuously, and then you have access at the time of you die. That is how you get reborn in those realms, not because you have one or two experiences of these things. So this is, to me, entirely the wrong way of thinking about things. And the chances of you becoming a stream mentor just by listening to a Dhamma talk is very, very small. In fact, I would say it's zero unless you have a jhana already. Maybe if you already have a jhana experience and then you listen to the Dhamma talk. And I think what this is coming from, there is a sutta called the Vimuttayatana Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. Vimuttayatana means like the spheres of liberation. That's literally what it means. And it talks about five or six different ways in which liberation happens. And one of those ways is by listening to Dhamma talks. Another one is by reciting the Dhamma. Another one is by teaching the Dhamma. Another one is by reflecting on the Dhamma. And the last one is by watching your breath and meditating. And in each one of those cases, and this is kind of the really important point, this is the point that is never mentioned. In each one of those cases, when you recite the Dhamma, when you listen to the Dhamma, when you reflect on the Dhamma, when you teach the Dhamma, in each case, joy arises in the mind. From the joy comes comes the pasaddi, the tranquility. From the pasaddi comes the sukha. From the sukha comes the samadhi. And from that samadhi, you see things in accordance with reality. So even in those cases where you're listening to the Dhamma, you need to go through the usual process and achieve samadhi before you can see things according to reality. So when you read the suttas, you have to read the full text and not just read part of it. And then you are kind of getting on the right track. So Yeah, so I think this is not a very good idea at all. In fact, all that you will end up doing is stopping yourself from achieving awakening with this kind of attitude there. So anyway, please don't think like this, yeah, because then you will be in trouble. Please don't. follow the Noble Eightfold Path, right? That is kind of that is the path to awakening, yeah. And the Noble Eightfold Path does include deep samadhi. All right. Dear Ajahn, thank you so much for the wonderful teachings. I am increasingly feeling educated, encouraged, fired up, and inspired over time. Given that the jhana is so often clearly mentioned in the suttas, I wonder why different Theravada schools seem to divide it over its emphasis in meditation. This is a very good question, and it has probably some very good historical... There's always good reasons for these things, once you know the history behind things. One of the reasons is that there tends to be an emphasis in later Buddhism on the later teachings, the teachings you find in the commentaries, teachings you find in the Abhidhamma, etc. And in those teachings, they are opening up sometimes the possibility for insight without kind of the jhanas. But what is interesting, that even in the commentaries, even in the sub-commentaries, even in the sub-sub-commentaries, sub-sub is like really present day. It's called the Abhinavatika, which means like the super new sub-commentary, written in Burma in the 19th century. The Burmese are the kind of the most famous of the scholars in Buddhism. And they, even until recent times, they're kind of still, I think even in the present day, they're writing sub-commentaries on the suttas. And so even in these commentaries, it is very rare to encounter what is called the dry vipassana path of meditation, where samadhi is not really mentioned. There is a word that you may have heard sometimes used in meditation, so it's called vipassana jhanas. You probably heard this word. Now, if you search for the word vipassana jhana in all of the all Pali text that exists, you find it mentioned maybe 20 times. If you search for the word jhana without vipassana, only in the suttas, only the four main nikayas, it is mentioned about 1,000 times, only in the four main nikayas. So vipassana jhana is only found in the sub-commentaries 20 times in everything that is written. The word jhana is found 1,000 times just in the four main nikayas. If you counted the total number of the word jhana overall, maybe 10,000 times, something like that. And still, we are talking about vipassana jhana as if it matters. If it occurs 20 times, why do we even talk about it? Then you look at other words that have a similar kind of bearing, like kanika samadhi. Kanika samadhi is sometimes called momentary samadhi. And you search for that, and again, you find again a tiny, tiny number of mentions in the suttas. And it's kind of strange why we make so much of very minority teachings, right? And the reason is very often is because we... it's enjoyable to look at things from a new angle. It is enjoyable to try to see things in a new way, to do things differently. And so we make a lot out of these minority teachings. This is a very common problem in Buddhism. It's a common problem even for those people who take the Nikayas or the suttas seriously. Very commonly what happens is that the suttas will have a certain enigmatic and poorly understood statements in them, because that is the way the suttas are. Always going to be some uncertain things. And then they get taken out and they get elucidated at great length. And then you interpret the majority of suttas in light of those very rare and unusual statements. And then, of course, everything becomes wrong as a consequence. So the right way, and this was pointed out to me by Ajahn Brahm a long time ago. He said he went to Sri Lanka, and when he was in Sri Lanka, he went to visit a monk called Venerable Nyanaponika, a German monk who was a very prolific scholar of Buddhism, and he was writing and translating and doing all kinds of things. He lived in a famous place called the Forest Hermitage in the Udavattakela Reserve outside of Kandy, and that's where kind of the Buddhist Publication Society was established. one of the kind of starting points of how Buddhism spread to the West because of their translations and their publication of things in English. So he was a very senior monk, and he was discussing with Ajahn Brahm, and he said precisely, made this point, that when you read the suttas, what you should do, you should read the preponderance of suttas, the main message. That should be the main thing that you worry about. And all the minor little teachings that seem to be special, that seem to be enigmatic, that seem to be strange, they should be interpreted in line with the main teachings, not the other way around. And so for this reason, this is how then Buddhism becomes distorted, because we put emphasis on the wrong things. The majority of people in the world, if you say the word vipassana jhana, they will have no idea whether it is an important teaching or not. You have to be a specialist in the suttas and the Dhamma to really know whether these things are important or not. And I can tell you for sure, these things are completely unimportant. They are such incredibly minority aspect of the suttas and the commentaries that they actually fade in comparison compared with the majority teachings. Same thing with Kanika Samadhi. They're not mentioned in the suttas at all. They're only found in these very sub-commentaries, etc. So this is how these things then happen. And then there are also historical reasons. There are books written about how these things kind of happened. One of the reasons apparently is because many of these things started out in Burma. Yeah, Burma is where the Vipassana tradition was very strong and Abhidhamma was very strong. They decided that the Samadhi things were too kind of supernatural. It doesn't fit with the modern way of thinking. The modern way of thinking is what came in with the West. When the Western kind of culture started to come to Asia, that obviously had an influence on the way of thinking. And in Burma, what happened was that, they wanted to become more rational in the way they approached Buddhism. Right, so they became, and the idea of being rational was to put aside the samadhi and focus more on vipassana and insight, because insight is rational, it's about seeing things as they actually are, whereas samadhi is very often associated with supernormal powers and all these kind of things, which wasn't really acceptable anymore because of the modern way of looking at things. So we all influence each other in this way, and then things react in accordance with that. And this is kind of the nature of things. Yeah? Every generation will understand Buddhism in new ways, our generation also understands Buddhism in a certain way. The next generation will again react to us, and they will come to us and say, "Oh, Ajahn Brahmali, you haven't understood anything. Yeah, look at the suttas here." And if I am wise, I will then accept that sometimes you make mistakes and sometimes your interpretations aren't maybe as perfect as you think. And then there will be a reassessment. And this idea of reassessing things will always kind of go on. But there are certain principles that we need to come back to. These are principles like the word of the Buddha being primary. Not the word of the acharyas, the teachers in the world. Putting the word of the Buddha first, and then really investigating what the Buddha is talking about. And some basic principles of that are usually enough to understand properly what Buddhism is about. And one of the things jhana, samadhi is absolutely fundamental to the Buddhist path. So something like that, it's complicated, in other words. Everything is always complicated in this world, just the way things tend to turn out. Anyway, so sorry for going on at length about that. Let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, perhaps this is a bit too philosophical, but it's something that I have had on my mind recently. Do you think that the truth and seeing things in accordance with reality are only in service of making an end of suffering and not sought out for its own right? Thank you for inspiring teaching, and thanks to the Buddha for sharing his wisdom with us. Awesome, awesome, awesome. That's the translation of sadhu, awesome. They're saying awesome three times. Truth, seeing things according to reality, are in the service of making an end of suffering. That is right. But of course, you can only find an end of suffering precisely because you are truthful, precisely because you see things in accordance with the reality. Yeah, because you need to see things straight. You cannot be deluded. And this is kind of the point. Yeah, the mind needs to be clear about things. Otherwise, you cannot make good decisions. Otherwise, you don't really know what's going on. So truth and ending of suffering must always go together. They can never be separate. Same thing with seeing things in accordance with the reality. So they have naturally belong together. Ajahn Brahmadi, lots of people here would like to hang around you. Really? Okay. Hope you would like to hang around us. I'm hanging around with you every day, right? For hours every day. So you kind of, this is what's happening now. So anyway, I have a question on the scene when the Buddha broke into verse just before leaving the mendicants at Kosambi. Who is there to record the verse and indeed to narrate the story? How should we understand it? Mega thanks, Ajahn. So this is a very good question. And this is one of the reasons why the most important statements that we find in the suttas are those statements spoken by the Buddha, because that is when people would be around, people would listen, he would give a discourse, people would record it with their mind, Ananda, when Ananda would be there, and he would kind of, his mind was like a tape, like a recorder, and he would get it kind of verbatim, bang, and it was stuck in his mind, a kind of extraordinary feats of memory that people did in those days. So that's why the word of the Buddha, when he teaches, is the most reliable and usually the most authentic, whereas the narrative is much more uncertain, because precisely who made up the narrative, we don't know. Or what we know that in part it was made up at what is sometimes known as the First Council. The First Council is the first communal recitation of the suttas after the Buddha passed away. And we know that at that council, they specifically ask questions like, where was this recited? Who was it recited by? Who was present? And these kind of things. So the narrative or the surrounding material was at least in part fixed after the Buddha passed away. We know that. And so for that reason, it is more uncertain, because memory is uncertain. The longer the time has passed, the more likely there is kind of deficiency in memory, etc. And this is the problem here, yeah, when the Buddha is there alone. Was there someone around to record that? Maybe someone was there. Yeah, maybe the Buddha had an upatak. Upatak is an attendant. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. It is very difficult to know exactly what happened in that particular case. So it is uncertain, yeah? And it is, we don't really know exactly what happened. But there are, of course, the most important part of the story of Kosambi is what we are reading now, which is the Buddha narrating about his own time before his awakening, trying to achieve samadhi. That is really the core of the sutta. And that is, again, the Buddha speaking, and the monks obviously recording that in their minds. But it is a good question, and it kind of, you wonder how authentic it is. Maybe there are some faults in there. Maybe it is not exactly what happened. On the other hand, it may also be because it was an important incident, and obviously the very incident of Kosambi happened, it may also be the case that some of that was actually remembered correctly. But there is always going to be a degree of uncertainty there. All right. Okay, I've got to talk fast now. Dear Ajahn, how do I test myself to know what level I am on at the road to enlightenment? How do I know when I'm enlightened? Okay, you know, right? That's kind of when you're enlightened, you know that you're enlightened. This is what it says in the suttas. Vimuttasming vimuttang ittinyanang hoti. When you are enlightened, the knowledge is there. I am enlightened. This is kind of what the suttas say. You know that rebirth has come to an end, and you know. So if you have doubts, you're not enlightened. So that's kind of the short answer. But don't worry about enlightenment. worry about only one thing, whether you're making progress on the path. That's the only thing that matters. If you're making progress, guaranteed, you will eventually become enlightened. So we tend to think about the path in the wrong way. It's not about having attainments or achieving states. It's about whether you're making progress. That's the only thing that matters. Okay, hi Ajahn, thank you very much for your inspiring teachings. Words are not enough to express the gratitude that comes towards you. Okay, well, that's wonderful. The way you express the suttas enormously increase our faith and sadhana towards the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. It is truly inspiring. How lucky we all are to have good virtuous teachers and blessed with their teachings. Thank you very much for your valuable time spending teaching us and spreading the Dhamma. Much merit to you. May you get enlightened within this lifetime. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. That's kind of my kind of question, my friend. So, all right. Dear Ajahn, from which Nikaya is the Sutta of the Sangahavattu from? Sangahavattu was a sutta I mentioned the other day about the four ways of creating a kind of a group and how groups get created around you, an entourage if you like. And it should be in the Anguttara Nikaya 4, the numerical discourse is the fourth chapter. You would find it in there, Sangahavattu. I'll see if I can remember and I can maybe bring out an exact reference for you later on here. Hi Ajahn, can we suggest to buy after book to our BSWA library? It is an eye-opening book. Thank you for telling it to us. I have read it. It's an amazing book. Yes, we can make that suggestion. We shall see. Anyone who remembers making that suggestion to the librarian, we can suggest that it's a good idea. We have it in the monastery library already. We had it. I lent it to some layperson. We haven't seen it since. But this is the danger of lending books. You never know what's going to happen next. But anyway. All right. Good evening, Ajahn Brahmali. Thank you once again for your wonderful teachings. I read Majjhima Nikaya 17. You mentioned you have good reasons for not leaving Bodhinyana should Ajahn Brahm ask you to do so. Reflecting for myself, I am now living close by a jungle thicket, i.e. Jhana Grove, for the retreat. The necessities of life that one requires, food, fabulous lodgings, medicines, and all whatever, all are plentiful. But my mindfulness has not become established. My mind has not become stilled in samadhi. My defilement has not come to an end. So according to the sutta, I should leave the retreat. And a kind of a very sour face come out after that. Since I didn't come to the retreat for the sake of food, etc., what is your advice? So, the thing to remember here is that when we look at whether your mindfulness becomes established and your samadhi becomes stilled or whatever, it is not doesn't happen in the short run. What we're looking at is the long run. Yeah, it takes time for these things to happen. And you should not evaluate things from one day to the next or even one week to the next, but maybe from 1 month or maybe over a period of 6 months. That is when you know whether your samadhi is established or not. So stay at Jhana Grove for 6 months. Yeah, that's kind of my advice to you, and then see what happens. Actually, that's not my advice to you at all, but that's kind of how you should maybe think about this. So look at what happens in your mind over time, from 1 year to the next one. And see when you go back home and you start to apply these teachings in your daily life, and you start to become a more caring, kind person, more moral person. And as you do that, come back to the Jhana Grove next year and then see if your mindfulness is more established than it was last year. Then you are looking at things in the right kind of time frame. Look at it over a very long period of time. That is the right way of thinking about this. And then you should see some kind of improvement, hopefully. So that is my advice. And even if you come here just to enjoy the food, it's okay. Because you cannot help but being influenced by what is happening here. Yeah, you will get something out of the teachings. There will be a sense of osmosis or the teaching seeping into you, because that's kind of the way it is. That's what I notice when I'm at Bodhinyana Monastery, I hang out at Rajan Ram. There's an osmosis going on. I become a better person whether I want to or not. And sometimes I don't want to be better. I want to be the way I am and be grumpy and negative. But actually, you just become better after a while, whether you want to or not. That's kind of the beautiful thing. And of course, it makes you much more happy as a consequence. So just by hanging out here, hanging out with a good company, just enjoying the food already, it's okay here. Yeah, that's fine. And then you are hopefully on the right track. All right. I'm going to do a couple of more questions, even though it's getting a little bit late. So let's see what happens. If everyone became monastics, wouldn't we all starve to death? Indeed, that is exactly what would happen, that we would all starve to death if everyone became a monastic. That's true, yeah, but it's not going to happen, right? So it doesn't really matter here. I think one of these things is that the way that monasticism is set up, it's set up with the thought that not everyone is going to become a monastic. If everyone did become a monastic, then you would have to change the way monasticism works. You would have some new rules. Right? So it functions precisely because everyone is not a monastic. And then if that were a problem, which is never going to be a problem anyway, because it's not going to happen, but if it did happen, you would just have to change the way you live the monastic life. Like, growing your own food or whatever. Dear Ajahn, thanks for the awesome teachings. I am intrigued now. Why are some people more zappable or able to receive transmission than others? if you kind of go back to this idea of being zappable in terms of kind of feeling something in the presence of others, I think it may be similar to things like some people are more liable to be hypnotized. Yeah, it takes a certain mindset, maybe a certain ability to let go, not to control, or something like that, that makes you possible to hypnotize. Not all people can be hypnotized. And I think maybe the zappability is something similar to that. It depends on your character, certain traits. Maybe you are less controlling character, more kind of spontaneous kind of person, and you just go with the flow. You're not such a control freak. Some people control their minds and the way they are a lot. Other people are much more kind of just go with the flow kind of people. So something like that, I think, might be the answer here. Dear Ajahn, thank you again for all your wise words. Each day you become more something. Not sure exactly what you're becoming more. I hope it's something good. More inspired. Inspired is the word. That's what you're saying here. Okay, good. Inspiring is good. Every day I become more disillusioned. That would have been kind of worrying. Yeah. So, question. During my meditation today, images and thoughts of a violent and very unpleasant event arose. My reaction was to cease the meditation as I couldn't have the feelings that arose. I couldn't, anyway. Any suggestions on what I might do if this occurs again? Many thanks and with gratitude. So this can sometimes happen in meditation practice because you are relaxing and sometimes difficult things from the past can come back, things that you have repressed a little bit and suppressed, and then because your mind is relaxing, these things can suddenly come out. So it is an opportunity to deal with these things, yeah? And sometimes that can be great because if you deal with them well, you're really overcoming some deep problems within you that may actually be blockages to meditation. So allow them to come out and try to re-evaluate those events. See them in a new way. Because the way we see these things from the past is very biased. And what you may remember as a very unpleasant event in the past can probably be looked upon in a completely different way. And one of the ways is that if someone treated you badly or you treated someone badly or whatever, is to come to that event through the eyes of compassion instead, seeing things in an entirely new way. If someone treats you badly and you have compassion for them, it certainly changes the game completely. Yeah, and actually it enables you to open up your mind to the world in a completely new way as a consequence. So take this as an opportunity. It may be that you cannot sit in your meditation anymore, but get up. And instead of pushing that thought out, try to deal with it, reevaluate it, see it in a new light. You are a different person now from what you were when that happened. You have more tools at your disposal in dealing with these things. Use those tools wisely, and you can transform some of the difficult events in your life into something completely different. This is kind of the power here. Yeah, there is a potential here for doing something very, very useful in your life. So give it a shot and see what happens. Okay, only two more questions left. Ajahn, does Attakatha mean commentary to the suttas? Yes, Atta means meaning, Katha means talk, so literally means talk on meaning. Is it available in English? No. These are only available in Pali. There's a tiny translations into English, but not very much. So you will notice that when you read translations, sometimes the translator will quote from the commentaries. And that is how you can get a little bit of understanding of the commentaries. So for example, if you read the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, translated by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, in the notes at the back, he will often quote from the commentaries. And then you will get some insight into what they are like. Generally speaking, it's pretty boring, I have to warn you. It's not very interesting at all. Where the suttas are inspiring, the Attakatha tends to be dry and boring and not very inspiring at all. Sometimes they can be interesting, but a lot of the time, not. Okay, last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, I find it hard to forgive myself for things in the past, even some things from many years ago. I think it may be deep remnants of my early religious indoctrination, which was very primitive in nature, punitive in nature. How do you advise to overcome this blockage? So the way to overcome it is just to keep on brainwashing yourself, yeah? Learning to see the world in a new way, understanding that you are not really responsible for things, yeah? Especially all that indoctrination that was punitive in nature, that in itself was a kind of brainwashing that was very negative, yeah? And difficult for you to deal with, and it kind of led you astray, led you in the wrong direction. So already there you have basis for having a lot of compassion for yourself. It is terrible that one should actually have to go through these negative religious experiences, because they block your ability to be kind to yourself. So that already should be a sense of kindness to yourself, this kind of background that you have. And that should also tell you, I think, fairly clearly that how much say do you have in your life? Yeah, you are indoctrinated in this way. You are being kind of brainwashed, but in a negative sense of the word. You are the victim of these things. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? And because you have been a victim all along, well, then again, have compassion for yourself. Understand that you're not really in charge. Understand that the right way is to forgive yourself for those things, because actually it is all out of control. Keep on working on this idea that you are the sum of the conditioning from the past, that your personality is like a trap. Your personality is a trap because your personality is that conditioning from the past. You have become that person because of cause and conditions. And instead of being proud of our personalities are more like prisons. They are the prisons of past conditioning. We have become who we are. And we want to release ourselves from those prisons by understanding the conditioned nature of these things, and then forgive ourselves because of that. Because we're not really in charge of these things. So just work on it. I think all the tools are there. And I talked about this at some length today also when we went through the Kosambi, the Upakilesa Sutta at Kosambi. We looked at those verses and we talked a bit about how the precisely about these issues, about being conditioned and being the victim of our conditioning. Gradually, you can overcome this. Keep on reflecting on it, yeah, again and again and again. And you will see yourself emerging from that prison, emerging from being a victim, and starting to liberate yourself. This is part of the path of liberation, liberating ourselves from this oppressive conditioning from the past. Okay, everyone, that is all for tonight, and I wish you all once again a wonderful rest tonight and a good sleep, and we'll see you back again tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock.